Invasive plants are a serious threat to many things in Wisconsin: native growth, healthy diversity in our natural areas, and can be a real headache for many, many people. Going to talk about how we can control those and how to identify them, what to do about them, with a couple of guests who are back. We had such a good time with them last time. We had to get them back to talk. Kelly Kearns, actually, Kelly's been with us a number of times. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin DNR. And Kelly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you back. And Mark Rentz. Mark is an associate professor, UW Extension weed scientist, works out of the Department of Agronomy at UW-Madison. And Mark, thank you for coming back as well. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, my pleasure to be here.
There have been some new invasive plants found in the state. In the first place, how many invasives do we even know how many invasives there are, Kelly?
Well, we currently have 145 plants that are listed as either restricted or prohibited in the state. About 40 of those are aquatic.
Here anyway, and, yeah.
Yeah, so a little over 100 are actually regulated, but there are more than that that are actually invasive. You know, some are not listed because they're so widespread already that there's really not much we can do about it. Some we're really not sure how much of a problem they're going to be causing. So it's really somewhere over 100. Some are probably between 100 and 200.
And there are some new ones out there that have been found recently in the state?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that we found recently. One is an impatiens, which is related to our native jewel weed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called policeman's helmet because the flower looks like an old English London Bobby's helmet.
Sure.
And it's got a very dark magenta pink flower. Are very large. This plant can get up to like 6-7 feet tall. Super invasive in Europe where it's spread. It's from Asia, but it's spread in Europe, and we're starting to see it spread over here in North America. And they've had problems with it in other parts of North America, and we've just started seeing it in a few places. We had one population up in a woodlot in Shawano County a number of years ago and had somebody that figured it out and got on top of it and basically got it eradicated very quickly. And then we found a couple other populations down in the Madison area, actually one Mount Horeb and one in Middleton just this year. And that one's pretty easy. It's one that you can pretty easily eradicate because it's an annual and it pulls easily. And really easy. Just hand pull it before it starts to flower. Don't let it go to seed and monitor it over the next couple of years and you can wipe out the population.
So that's an easy one. There are some that aren't so easy.
Yeah, there's definitely some that aren't so easy. And so we have a number of different ones. We have a tree that we've been finding in a few places, a cork tree, that has really spread in a few places where it was planted. And it's only the females that are a problem. The males, they are out there, but they're not the ones spreading their seeds. And so it's the females in that case that we actually have prohibited in the state.
And Mark, controlling this right now is a good season, is it not, to do some control on invasives?
Yeah, that's right. With especially with our perennial species, the fall is a great time to conduct control. Many of them are like Japanese knotweed or just starting to flower. And so this is really a great time to go after them. If you're going to use herbicides tend to translocate well into the roots. And things like Japanese knotweeds, Phragmites, this is the ideal time to conduct management. So if you can get after them, great. It's a wonderful weather. We have a great falls in Wisconsin. Good excuse to get outside and tackle some of these nasty pests.
Don in Madison has a question for you. Let's go there. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question about ragweed.
Okay.
As you probably know, it's one of the worst allergens out there. It's found all over city property. And my mother-in-law tells me she grew up in Duluth where they wanted to advertise people to come up there because it's ragweed-free. And so they'd have kids go out and pick the plants, and I don't remember how many they had to get in order to get a penny. But they virtually wiped out all the ragweed. And I'm just so surprised when I'm on city property and it's so abundant. How can we get rid of ragweed?
Well, Don, that's a real interesting question. So first off, believe it or not, ragweeds, there's two types. There's common and giant. They are native to Wisconsin. So we do not term those as invasive plants because they're native. Now, that doesn't mean that they're troublesome and undesirable. I think most people would agree with that. A fun fact about ragweeds is that they're actually currently highly invasive in Europe, and they're actually acting very invasive there and causing big issues. So while it's not an invasive plant, it's not really a desired plant. They are both annual plants, so there's a range of options for controlling them. But where we see them on public property are typically in areas that are minimally managed. And so if they're not managing them, it's really a struggle or almost impossible to control them. Management from simple well-timed mowing to hand pulling to herbicide application, any of those can all be very effective if timed appropriately. It's just making that decision to manage them and having that a high priority for, say, public parks and other areas.
Mm. The problem is on our public lands, they just don't have a lot of land management budget for most public agencies. And so mowing is one of the things they've been reducing in order to reduce costs, because it's a lot of labor hours to do mowing. And so they're trying to prioritize where they do that. So, you know, sharing information about where there is large ragweed problems with your local land management organization would be useful for them probably.
And thanks again for calling. Lucy in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Lucy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I am an herbalist, and I just want to make a comment that the invasive illnesses we have sometimes are helped by the invasive plants that we have, especially like for Lyme disease. Japanese knotweed is one of the leading herbs being used right now. So it's just, and things like burdock, boneset, other things I've heard that you're considering invasive may actually be here for a reason, and try to think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and certainly some of the reasons why some of these plants were introduced was because of their herbal properties. But that doesn't necessarily, just because they're useful for herbal purposes, doesn't prevent them from becoming invasive and spreading into our natural areas. So certainly for things like Japanese knotweed and teasel that are good for Lyme disease, we encourage people to dig those up and use the roots. And as long as you're not selling live plants or live roots, then you're welcome to use those roots for their herbal properties. And I think it's great that they have some function.
It's great that they are used. Lucy, thanks. Mike in Castle Rock, give you a chance. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. The biggest spreader of invasive species here in this county is the Highway Department and the Department of Natural Resources. They own property here along the creek, Castle Rock Creek, and it's full of invasive species. I'm battling here with parsnips, and they don't do anything.
Well, let's go back. Kelly, do you want to make a comment?
Sure. Highways have, for a long time, have been kind of a venue for where invasive plants are spreading, especially things like parsnip that tend to go into seed fairly early in the season. And if the roadsides are mowed after they've gone to seed, then yes, they're going to be spread. So we've been working with highway departments around the state, and these are all county highway departments or town highway departments generally, and trying to get them to mow earlier. And for state highways, they're actually mandated now to mow generally before parsnip would go to seed. You know, parsnip is probably the most obvious one that's being spread on roadsides, but there's a lot of others as well, and they all have slightly different phenologies, different times that they bloom, times that they go to seed. And so, for example, you can't mow for garlic mustard at the same time that you're going to be mowing for wild parsnip. And generally, their funds for mowing is pretty limited, and so they can only often mow one time a year or maybe two times a year at the most, and so they have to try to time that. And yes, there's a lot of training we still need to be doing of a lot of these highway departments and trying to encourage them to mow at the right time.
Yeah, you guys don't do any mowing.
On DNR properties?
Yeah.
It depends on the purpose of the property. You know, if it's, generally it's for access, so like if it's a fisheries management property, they'll just mow access areas so people can get in without having to go through the weeds. Mm-hmm. But generally they're not going to mow the whole area. So there's way too much DNR property for be able to mow most of it, and we just don't have the funds to do that.
Yeah. And, Mark, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well-timed mowing is a great and easy management strategy that can work. The problem is I think you mentioned a creek, And in those waterway systems, it's even more of a challenge to get a mower in there and mow. And unfortunately, wild parsnip, once it gets in a watershed on a creek or a river, a riparian zone, tends to spread rapidly. And really, in order to conduct management, you got to stop at the top of the creek, manage those populations first, because what happens if you don't? You could do everything you can to reduce it on your population, but that creek floods, and that seed's just going to come right back down to you in the future years, too. And so that's really the struggle, and that's why we try to get rid of invasives before they establish, because when you're in a situation like you've described, it's really challenging. You need to get all your neighbors together and all the land managers together to conduct management, and that's really a challenge.
Yeah, it definitely is. Mike, thanks for bringing it up. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question or comment as we talk about invasive plants with our two guests, Mark Rentz and Kelly Kearns. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions and comments there. And, you know, and just, Mark, in terms of organizing and so forth, there's a fair amount of education that can be done, and you guys are have some workshops coming up to help people along those lines.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. I mean, the caller made a really good point that, you know, municipalities need some education and training on this, and that's one of the goals that Kelly and myself are really interested in, is creating training where we can educate them not only on the background of what this issue is, but also some hands-on training where we get out there in the field with them. We show them what these plants look like. We show them management techniques. We show them some of the invasive earthworms that we have. And so we've working with the University of Wisconsin Extension, Team Horticulture, and DNR, we've put together 6 workshops that are going to be held starting tomorrow throughout the state to address these issues. These workshops are going to be tomorrow. We're going to be in Oshkosh. Then the next day, on the 16th, we're going to be in Green Bay, going to go up to Menominee, and then going to be in Clinton, Waukesha, and Stevens Point. So these are really great events targeted towards municipalities, but anyone is welcome to attend. There will be a slight fee, but we're going to give you lots of resources that will overcome that fee, and you're going to get treated to a wonderful lunch. We're trying to get some of our local legislatures there to comment on the issue. So it should be a great event. So if you're interested in invasive species, we really encourage you to attend one of these events.
And we've posted the information up on our Facebook page. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you can find all the specifics on the training, the workshops that are available or may be available in your area. And we've got some other reports on invasives as well that we posted up there that Mark's provided and Kelly had provided. So you want to learn some more that way, too. There are those items are posted up there. So we'll probably mention that again, but just keep in mind, go to our Facebook page, take a look and see if this appeals to you. I'm Larry Mueller, and Brandy Funk, our on-air producer today, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, by the way, according to a water expert, the California drought situation is much worse than what we really know. Kathleen's going to talk about that at 2 today here on the Ideas Net. Right now, Mark Rentz from the University of Wisconsin Extension and the Department of Agronomy at UW-Madison. One of our guests, the other, Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. And we're certainly great to have her along today as well. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you're up on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post your question, comment, or maybe you've got a weed you're wondering, what the heck is this weed? And you've got a photo of it. We'll take a crack at identifying it. I bet one of these two, or probably both of them, are going to know what it is. Stephen Madison has a question for you next, so let's go there. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Hey, I'll take my answer off the air, but I have a neighbor who in the city has planted wisteria, and is it an invasive vine? And it's an ornamental vine. And I'm just wondering how invasive this thing is. It's really hard to get rid of. We're trying to get rid of it, but what do we do?
All right.
Okay, there's actually several different species of wisteria, and some of them are native to North America, and some of them are not. And the ones that are invasive are the ones that are not, and those are the Japanese and the Chinese wisteria. And they supposedly aren't hardy this far north, but we definitely have seen them spreading in some areas. We have one property up in Adams County where it's taken over acres and acres, and it's... You know, it's one of the non-natives, and we're not really sure how it was able to do it when it's not supposed to be hardy. But so it certainly is something that can spread. So the first thing to find out is which species it is that they have. And you can go online and to the Wisconsin DNR website, and there's some more information about the different wisterias there. And you can try to help figure out which one it is that you have. And then
my neighbor may know that already. I have another neighbor that used a great deal of 2,4-D on the crazy thing, and I've been pulling it. The tentacles just spread with this thing, and it's just incredible.
What's the best way to control it?
Well, I think that it's, you know, there's not a lot of research that's actually been done on controlling wisteria because most people want to propagate it and spread it. But it probably would act like many of our other brush species, that there are some herbicides that we would probably lean to because it does have a creeping root system. And pulling it, unless you have a big excavator and you can get to those underground roots, I would probably guess that over half of the biomass of that species is below ground. So you'd have to pull it for many, many, many years to really get an advantage. So then it comes down to a herbicide application. And if you're willing to do so, it's timing that herbicide application to maximize control. And it's not a surprise that 2,4-D didn't work well. There's probably other herbicides that work better. And you could even do some brush-type applications called a cut stump or cut surface or a basal bark application to those woody stems that come up out of the ground and get better control. We have some good resources that on our website. If you just Google Wisconsin and weed science, you'll see a brush management guide that kind of describes those techniques and how to utilize those.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. Tom in Appleton has a comment. Hi,
right,
Tom.
Hi, Kelly. I was one of the participants in Menominee Falls last week. Hey, the guy called about ragweed growing on unmanaged land, and I just got a short story I want to relate to you guys, that somewhat miraculous situation. So I planted 6,000 seedlings on some land I own up in O'Connell County, and it was corn the year before, Roundup Ready corn, so there was no carryover in the herbicide, and that field exploded in lesser ragweed to the point where it was literally the only thing you could see for the entire field. It was a wet year, so even though lesser, it was head higher, taller, really quite a crop of ragweed. Year over year, in one year, with no maintenance on my part, that entire field changed over to perennial native forbs like Canada goldenrod, various asters. So where those plants are in the vicinity, that is, you need a seed source, they can't come out of nothing, they will take over. And of course, they grow taller than the ragweed, and they'll shade it out. There's no ragweed there at all anymore, and I did nothing.
That's a surprising story.
That is a very surprising story.
It's a true story.
I don't doubt it at all. But
I believe it. I mean, I think ragweed is a common weed species, and like all common weed species, they thrive in disturbance. And so since you did not introduce any disturbance, you're allowing some of those later successional species like you described take over. And they will eventually outcompete it to a certain degree. And so it's not that big of a surprise. I'm just surprised there's none of it there. I would have thought there would still have been some of it there.
Yeah.
I can't find a single plant.
That's great, Tom.
And again, it was year over year that change happened.
Wow.
Kind of amazing.
It is.
You need to go into business to try and sell them.
I am in the business.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Wow. That is that was a really good result. Bob in Rosholt, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, I got one for you, too. I've been fighting a patch of Canada thistle for 20 years. And a situation where I can't use herbicides, 1,000 square feet, I'd mow it, hit it with a scythe, dig it up. This year it went away, gone. And I'm delighted. Why do you think that happened?
Well, you know, Canada thistle is a real interesting plant. We've done a lot of work in our lab on it. And what we found is that it has these boom and bust years that occasionally, and we can't figure it out, we've been trying to research it, occasionally populations just bust and the plant just kind of disappears. We've always attributed to, we put out a really big study in that area studying different ways to control Canada thistle, and then it goes away. That's usually our way of figuring it out. So we don't really know why. The bad news is it typically does come back, but at a reduced stature. So don't plan on it being eliminated. We think it has to do with there's several native and potentially non-native diseases that are impacting its populations. There's two to three that we've looked at. If you ever see a Canada thistle stem that's white, looks like it's been bleached white, that's a bacteria that's infecting that stem, and that's one of them. And there's several other pathogens that may be responsible for that. But good to hear it's gone for the year. Let's hope it stays down. And when you see it come back, be really active at managing it, because you can keep those populations down pretty easily.
And thanks again for calling. Holly in Middleton, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Ironically, I have a Canada thistle comment or two. I moved into a newer development, and in the process of knocking down the thistle as we speak, although there's several areas along some of the other housing areas that also have the thistle, so people either can't afford to get it taken care of or are unaware of what they might do with it. And I'm wondering what the responsibilities are or if there's any regulations in place as far as the developers go. When they develop these areas and they are not removing some of these things, they're good at removing the topsoil that would be nice for all of us to have, but they're not removing some of these invasive plants and weeds that are very obvious. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Holly.
Well, when you do something like take an area, rip off the topsoil, and then you have the area disturbed for a while you're building houses and grading it and doing all of that, you're going to get weeds. It's just inevitable, because the soil has just been disturbed so much that the native plants and whatever else you had there originally just is not going to be there. You're going to get the weedy species. And usually that's just for the first few years, unless you get something like a perennial like Canada thistle that comes in. And that's where starting management from the very beginning, as soon as that you start seeing that, you know, the disturbance, you know, from the invasives coming up, then they should be doing some management. They are not required to control most of these species if they're a restricted invasive species. If it's a prohibited invasive, then they definitely are, but it's unlikely that that's some of the ones you have. However, there is a law that has been on the books for a long time called the Noxious Weed Law that is only enforced at the local level. And Canada thistle happens to be one of the three species that's on that list and that people are supposed to control. However, it needs to be dealt with by your local weed manager, and most municipalities don't even have anyone that really has that as their job description. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to get developers to follow along with this. It's really up to the residents to kind of force the issue.
There we go. Thanks, Holly, for calling. Appreciate it. Laura in Mount Horeb, thank you for calling. Hi.
I was wondering how you go about getting permission to go into public lands like state parks and things to harvest, and some things before you mow, or even some of the invasive species. I have a lot of friends who, you know, collect nettle and motherwort and all those different things. And I was also at the state park just before they mowed down all of this lovely St. John's wort that I would have loved to harvest. And if you have a way for people to harvest before things get mowed, or just a way to get permission,
Mm-hmm. Sure. So on any DNR lands, you can harvest some things without having to get any permission. So that would be edible nuts, fruits, berries, wild asparagus, and edible mushrooms. And so all of those things you can just go in and harvest on your own without having to ask permission. If it's anything else, you really need to ask permission of whoever the property manager is. So in that case, it would be the state parks manager. For the most part, they're probably going to say, great, go ahead, take all the nettles you want. Take all the St. John's wort you want. It's a good idea to get that in an email that you can then have printed off with you just in case anybody challenges you, whether it's another visitor or, you know, someone else, if they question what you're doing. For the most part, the property managers are going to be glad to let you take some of those things. And you need to talk with them ahead of time as to so find out, you know, I want to be harvesting this St. John's wort. Do you plan on mowing this year? And if so, can you let me know when it's going to happen?
I will definitely do that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Laura, for calling. And Tim and Shano, hi to you. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. This is Tim and Shano, and I just, I'm the property owner in Shano County with the ornamental jewel weed, the policeman's helmet, on their property. Yep. I guess I just wanted to kind of talk about it a little bit. We've had the property about 6 years, and it's not eradicated. It's there. We continue to pull it every year. I've had, you know, little to no. It's been a little bit frustrating. I've had little to no help from the state. You know, we ID'd it, and it, you know, I was told, oh, this is so terrible, and it's, you know, everybody, you know, was so concerned, and then nothing was done, and no help was given. There was a couple of years ago, there was a guy from an aquatic invasive species program who took a big interest and, oh, this is terrible, and he helped come out and pull it, and then, you know, nothing. He just disappeared, and come to find out he took a different position and the ball was dropped. This summer I actually had some help from a program called TIP that services Menominee, Shano, and O'Connell County. I believe they're a nonprofit that actively helps with invasive species. And they were actually pretty helpful, and he kind of discussed some of the issues we've had in the past with the lack of help. But you know, if you have something like this where, you know, I was told, oh, we were the first place in the state to have this ID'd, you know, it would seem like somebody should take an interest to help, you know, eradicate it and get on top of it. But it was like, oh, this is so terrible, and then there was nothing. And I understand that there's, you know, budgets and whatnot, but, you know, it's not eradicated on our property. You know, every year there's still thousands of seeds in the ground we go through and pull, you know, probably in July, and then kind of again here too. I was out the other day pulling. It's an ongoing battle, and, you know, I just...
Frustrating.
I didn't like to hear that, oh, it was up in Shano, but that's eradicated. You know, because it's, you know, not only did I get no help, you know, and now you're... It's just kind of, you know, swept under the carpet like, oh, it's done. It's taken care of. It's not taken care of.
Yeah. All right.
Okay. Well, first of all, Tim, thank you for calling in. And I apologize for that. That wasn't exactly the same report that I got from the fellow from TIP that went up and visited. He did say that you guys had been controlling it and had it pretty well under control, and therefore it wasn't really being a problem. So I appreciate that you guys are taking care of it on your own. His situation is kind of unique in that your woodlot is kind of surrounded by farm fields, correct?
No, we have farm fields on three sides, but then to the north, we butt up pretty much right up against Menominee County, which is a ton of forest.
Okay, yeah. I wasn't told that. Yeah, this is part of the problem is that, you know, I work statewide, and I can't get to all these sites, and so we work with a lot of our partners. And unfortunately, because of funding issues, there's a lot of turnover on those kind of staff. And so, as you mentioned, the one guy that was working on it with you ended up moving off to a different mm-hmm. position. And so the reason why the fellow from the Timberland Invasives Partnership came to meet with you this year is he's with with the Cooperative Invasive Species Management Area, and these are groups, regional groups around the state that are working on invasive plant issues. And so we happen to have a small amount of funding to go after some of these prohibited plants this year, and that was one of them that we hadn't heard about what was going on, and so we specifically got some money to Timberland so they could come out and help you folks this year. And so hopefully we'll be having some additional funding over the next couple of years that we can send him out to help you again. So yeah, let's stay in touch about this, and we'd be glad to help you figure out how we can help you keep that controlled.
And you can always, Kelly, you're always, if you go to the DNR website and type in invasive plant species coordinator or something like that, your name's going to pop up.
Right. Yeah.
So there we go.
So thank you, Tim.
Thanks a lot, Tim, for calling. Appreciate it. Dan in Viola has a comment as well. Let's go there. Hi, Dan. Oh. Thank you for calling.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. I've been dealing with some of these invasive species for a long time, having worked on prairies a lot of my life. And I've got an eight-acre parcel out here that was, a third of it was probably poison parsnip when I moved here 15 years ago. And I've eliminated it by not letting it flower, cutting it when it flowers. Not letting it go to seed, rather, cutting it when it flowers and being persistent about that. And in a few years, it gradually disappears because it's a biennial. It is a biennial, and it grows from seed. But the problem with it being here is the roadside mowing. The roadside mowing is becoming a real problem. It's creating an epidemic of it around here. There's in the Kickapoo Valley. I've been noticing fields of 60, 80 acres or more that are completely covered with it. And, the mowing should not be taking place until after the, it shouldn't take place after the third week of June. The seeds are just very, very numerous, and the roadside mower has changed over the last decade or two. They've gone to a rotary mower rather than a sickle mower, which used to just lay the plants down, but now the rotary mower picks up the seeds and spreads it after the tractor tires, the lugs in the tractor, break the soil, and the seeds are just, I've never seen such a an invasive, fast-moving plant as this wild parsnip. And the garlic mustard also is on its way to becoming doing the same thing in the area. So,
you got some problems there, Kelly. A comment from you or Mark? Mark, let's go to you.
Yeah, as we mentioned earlier, mowing too late in the season really will just spread wild parsnip. And part of the NR40, which is the invasive species rule, is that it is illegal to transport these restricted plants when they're in seed. And so we're trying to work with these highway departments to try to get them to mow when the things aren't in seed. And unfortunately, it's really hard to get to those individual township highway departments. Counties are a little bit easier, but even there, that's tough as well. We got 72 counties, and we have a lot of townships, and we really just don't have any good way to reach all those guys that do the mowing on those township roads. And it would be great at the local level if you can talk to them and explain to them what these species are and why they should be mowing when they're in the early flowering stage. And it should be pretty easy for them to do that.
And so, to some extent, Dan, if you can do that and if every individual could do that, because you're absolutely right. How many townships are there? Oh, my goodness. Hundreds.
Over 1,000.
Yeah, over 1,000. So this is something I think where the public itself, Mark, could really be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, and I want to commend you, Dan. I mean, I think it's great that you've done that. I think you're right on with your recommendations. Mowing it at that time frame in your neck of the woods, which is right when the plant starts to flower, when those axillary buds start to flower, which in a more common time is right around the 4th of July, but might be a little bit earlier in the Kickapoo region. That's the ideal time to mow. I think one of the other issues is we've gone to where we're not mowing the whole roadside, we're just mowing a strip. So there's always other areas that are adjacent that are not mowed where that wild parsnip can still go to seed and still spread its seed. The one good news I'll say, and Dan, you pointed it out, is that it is an easy plant to manage, and 2 to 3 years of high-intensity management, you'll see that population dramatically sink and be reduced. So some quick management, you'll see those results, but you got to want to be able to manage it, and that's the biggest struggle.
Yeah. There we go, Dan. Thanks very much for calling. And Dan says, yeah, well, that's true. It's not easy.
No, it's not. And, you know,
it's a lot of work.
And a lot of these people have had their budgets extremely cut, making it tough to do. So that's why they've gone to this one mow system and mowing less of the roadside. There's a lot of good reasons for it, but one of the unintended consequences is we're seeing invasive species spread.
And thanks again for calling. David Minocqua, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Larry, thank you for having me on your show. I tuned in a little late, but I heard somebody complaining about that they had too much vines growing, wisteria vines.
Yeah.
And what I was going to say was last year we had a big tree fall down on the edge of the yard. It fell into the wood line, but it let a big stump up, and it was too hard to go and cut this big tree up. You know, they would have had to get big machinery down there and stuff. So I thought, you know, I'm going to plant a vine around there. And I went to 3 different garden stores and bought vines. And I love to garden. I've gardened my whole life, you know. And I thought, I'm going to grow some good vines. These are supposed to be deer-proof. And I can't remember. That was last year. I tried 3 different times. I spent just under $100 trying to get vines that were supposedly deer-proof. And I gave them plant food. And I think the death knell was I gave them Epsom salts. This might attract the deer, but the deer up here are extremely voracious. And every time I planted that vine, it got going real good. It was to encompass the stump, if you get what I'm saying. The stump was turned toward our house, and the roots and all. And I cut all the roots off, but the tree was too big. And so I was growing these vines, and they were doing real good. And each time the deer came and just completely ate it right down to the ground. And they were supposed to be deer-proof. I was going to ask your guest if she would be kind enough to tell me, is there anything deer-proof?
Boy, I don't know. I would guess, if anything, probably Virginia creeper, which is a native vine that you should have up in your area and grows very aggressively and would cover up that tree pretty quickly, I imagine. But it is a very common, quite abundant vine in woods around the state, so I can't imagine that the deer do too much damage to it. And then, of course, grapevines as well.
Yeah, there you go. So a couple of options there, at least. Maybe one real good one, Dave. Thanks again for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Mark and Mequon a chance to coming up. There's a line open for you as well at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking invasive plant species today with Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and Mark Rentz, who is an associate professor at the UW with the UW Extension and the Department of Agronomy at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Again, join in. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, post a question or even a photo on our Facebook page. Maybe you've got a plant, a weed you might want to have identified. They can take a crack at it. Or, of course, call. All our lines are filled right now, but the number is 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Mark and Mequon next. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding buckthorn. I have about an acre of woods on my property, and it is just infested with buckthorn. I've been battling it for at least 15 years and without success. I've sprayed it, I've cut it, and then sprayed the stumps, all without success. And I'm looking at potentially burning it out or having goats come in. Someone told me that that's a possibility, to have goats come in and eat it. And I'm just wondering if you have any information about the effectiveness of those.
Yeah, well, you know, buckthorn is like our number one woody invader in Wisconsin. I would say, you know, super common situation that you've encountered. And it's not an easy plant to control. I mean, when in the situation you describe, if you were to go out and contract with a company to come in and control that. The estimates are usually upwards of $1,000 per acre is what these contractors would charge to clean up that infestation. So it's going to take an integrated approach, many-pronged attack. We have, on the flip side, is we have seen success of some of the herbicide treatments, and I'm going to, in a second, point you to some resources that can help you kind of research that to make sure your technique and how you applied them was correct. But it's a challenge, and it's going to be a long-term approach on how to handle it. Burning, if you can get that fire hot enough, will remove the above-ground stems. It's just dependent on the fuel, but it's not going to damage the below-ground crowns unless that fire gets incredibly hot, which I'm sure it won't in a forestry setting. So burning the plus wood, it will remove the above-ground canopy, but what's going to happen is you're going to get ample resprouting that you're going to have to manage. So I think burning alone is probably not a good thing, but burning followed up with other management tools can be really effective. Also address goats. Goats can and will eat buckthorn. If you can get them to feed on that continually for several years, they likely will kill those plants, but it's going to take repeated applications over several years to do so. And there's actually a graduate student researching how many years of goats feeding on buckthorn and other invasive woodies it's going to take to kill it. But it's going to take several years to do that because those plants are very old and they're going to need to continually eat it. But I must say, it's a great educational opportunity. Those goats will climb into the buckthorn, tear down stems, and it's pretty neat to see them operate. But you would have to either purchase your goats or rent those from a local person. And there are several individuals that will lease out those goats for invasive plant control. We do have all this control information put into a database. So if you're a computer savvy person, you can go to MIPN, M-I-P-N, control database .wisc.edu. And that's a database that lists control options and lists effectiveness and how to do these various control options. And it's available. And I think, Larry, do you have it on the website?
Well, Brandy will put it up. What is it again? Give it to us again.
MIPN control database .wisc.edu. So it's MIPN control database .wisc.edu. And what that allows you to do is enter information like, this is the species I'm interested in. This is the scenario I have. These are the control tactics I'm interested in. You can search for those control tactics and select your best approach. And I think in your case, Mark, it'll allow you to check on those management techniques you've been utilizing and see if you've maybe not been applying that herbicide at the right time or doing something different than we recommend, because we have lots of details there.
Yeah, great. Okay. Thanks,
great.
Mark.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Terry in North Lake. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for calling, or for taking my call. I have a question that doesn't quite fit the topic. I have, I'm trying to encourage lupins and planted sprouted seeds in various areas of the property, and I had a few seeds left over and threw them into an old bathtub that I put soil in. And those are the ones that did wonderfully, and I'm wanting to know if I can transplant them and at what time I can transplant them.
Okay. So I assume this is the native lupin that you're working with, not the ornamental one? Okay, good. The ornamental one can be somewhat invasive. So native lupin, its native habitat is sandy soil. And from what I can tell, you're in the outskirts of Milwaukee. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So you probably don't have the best soils for lupin. So that's probably why it's not doing very well there. And I happened to do my master's research on transplanting a number of different prairie plants, and one of them was lupin, and it does not transplant well. You would have to really get the entire root system. And if you're going to be doing that, you're going to want to do it probably in the fall and on a rainy day, or make sure that you keep it watered really well for a while. But it has a long taproot that really does not transplant very well. You're certainly welcome to try it. But I think what you really need to do if you want to grow lupin is you're going to need to amend your soil and get and it likes it more acidic and more sandy.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Terry. Appreciate it. And Jennifer in Cassville, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I live in the southeast corner of the, or southwest corner of the state,
And we have several rivers, the Grant River being one that we kayak down regularly. And there's a lot of agriculture on either sides of those rivers, cows and corn mostly. But what we've been seeing for the last 2 years is this large influx of tall, woody plants that are kind of have a stinging nettle-y feel, and they have big, roundish leaves. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with this plant.
Yes, unfortunately we are.
What is that?
Japanese hops. It's related to the beer hops that grows that people grow for beer, but this one is actually not very good for beer. The hops are not usable for that. And we don't know how it got into the southwest part of Wisconsin, but it is unfortunately completely taking over the shorelines of the rivers in the far southwest part of the state. So the Grant River, the Platte, the Little Platte, all of those are just being inundated. And this is an annual vine. And so in 1 year, it goes from a seed to producing fruits. And it spreads downstream and, you know, in the floodplains. And it's so aggressive, it can even kill out reed canary grass, which is what the main grass is that people find on most stream corridors. And it is an incredible weed. And at this point, we really don't have a good way of controlling it because, as Mark mentioned earlier, if you tried to control it on your property, if you had a shoreline, it's just going to come in from upstream. Or in a flooded year, it'll maybe even come in from downstream where the seeds can float upstream. And so that's a real problem species. And at this point, we're just trying to keep it out of additional stream corridors.
Mm.
So how do you do that? I mean, when you're it seems to have an oily substance that it extrudes under the water. I don't know if that it seems to cause rashes and so forth. Is this stuff brought in by herbicidal corn?
No, I don't think so. No. This plant just happened to show up in those areas, and this is how it spreads. It likes floodplains, and that's how it spreads. And these disturbed floodplains that have a lot of silt on them, and that's just where it thrives. And so what we're trying to do is to identify it when it's getting into new watersheds and hand pull it before the fruits are developed. And so that's actually pretty easy to control if you can catch it right away. But the problem is we need people who are paddling those rivers to learn to identify it and to just get out and control and pull it when they see it.
Mm, there we go. Thanks.
So the farmers, the riverways are not owned by the farmers, but the farmers use the riverways. So would that be farmers' responsibility or...
Well, actually, the generally land ownership goes to the middle of a stream, and so generally the farmers would own those shorelines. Is it their responsibility to remove it? If they could. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this is a restricted plant because it's so abundant we can't expect people to control it there. And so we really... you know, we don't require that farmers control it because we don't really have a good way for them to do that.
Oh, that's the problem. Thanks, Jennifer. I wish we had a little better news on that one, but unfortunately we don't, unfortunately. And Eileen in Baraboo, I believe it's...
That's me. I'd like to know how to get rid of poison oak. All of a sudden, it appeared where it never had been before around concrete. And I live on a small farm, and I'm just wondering how I can best control it. I've used Bayer, like a bushwhacker liquid, to spray on it, and now it's turned reddish, but I don't know if it's the fall coming or what.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Eileen.
Mark?
So first, how it got there, it has berries. And birds enjoy these berries, and they eat these in berries, and they ingest them through their system, and they deposit them, as I like to say, in a nutrient-rich fertilizer when they're done. So that's how it got there in this area. So how do you control it? There's a range of options. It's a woody perennial, and this is one of the few cases where I get very few complaints when I recommend using a herbicide because you don't want to hand pull, you don't want to mow or do anything else because you don't want to touch it. Typically, herbicides that contain the active ingredient triclopyr work best. And if you go to a local garden center or Home Depot or Menards or whatever and look for the herbicide that says brush and poison ivy killer, that will contain the active ingredient triclopyr, and you should apply it anytime that plant is actively growing. The fact that it's turning red so early is an indication that it's working. These usually do take several weeks to over a month sometime to show some sort of mortality. So when did you spray it?
Maybe 3 weeks ago, before we had hot weather.
Yeah.
And then we had cold weather, and now I'm thinking about going out and giving it another shot to kill it.
Yeah, well, I think it certainly wouldn't hurt, and without seeing it, it's hard to say how if it's going to die or not, but certainly you've put some hurt into it. Typically that herbicide needs actively growing tissue to be absorbed. So if it's not actively growing, I would wait until that happens. But my guess is it's just slowly dying.
Should I wait until spring to see what it's doing?
I would say that. I don't think you definitely have caused some damage. I don't think it's necessary to do a retreatment yet. Just wait until spring and see if you actually, in fact, killed it. My guess is if you use the correct product, you did.
And okay. I do want to point out that you probably have poison ivy, not poison oak. Here in Wisconsin, the vine that most people are familiar with, the leaves of three, let it be, that's actually poison ivy. Poison oak is really found further west in the United States.
Yeah. So there you go. Thank you so much for calling. I had a friend who didn't identify it, and it was growing in her backyard. And she thought, well, I just get pulleys out by hand with wearing shorts. So you can imagine what the next few weeks were like for her. Oh, my.
You make that mistake once.
Yeah, you don't make it again. You don't, definitely don't make it again. Kelly Kearns of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, one of our guests. The other, Mark Renz, associate professor and agronomist at the University of Wisconsin Extension and UW-Madison. They'll be with us right up till 12:30. We'll have a quick look at the news, then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When we take a look at invasive species, there's always lots of calls and questions, and certainly that's the case today. Our guests, two guests for you, Mark Renz, Extension Weed Scientist, Associate Professor at the UW-Madison. Great to have you back, Mark.
Thank you.
And as well, Kelly Kearns, been with us a number of times. She's the invasive plant coordinator for the Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the DNR. And Kelly, thank you for coming back as
sure.
well. We have many callers online. We have some Facebook comments. We have some email questions. We have a state highway worker called in just to say that the state regulates the when and the how of roadside grass mowing.
And that's only on state highways. That's all they have authority over. But basically, they have told the county highway departments, which actually do the mowing on the state highways, when they need to mow so that they can prevent the spreading of some of these invasives. And they only have the funds to mow one time a year, unfortunately, on state highways.
Yeah, so there we go. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Steve in Boulder Junction has a question. Hi, Steve.
Hi, I've got a red pine windbreak on the long side of my property, and the red pine are about 40 to 50 years old, probably. They're pretty mature. But now I've got buckthorn in between them. And actually, the buckthorn is not unattractive. It's green and leafy, so I don't mind it, and it's not going to spread out of there because it's windbreak is mowed on both, well, on three sides and the other side up to a road. Is there any reason for me to try to get rid of it as long as it's not bothering me?
Well, you certainly aren't required to get rid of it. And unfortunately, it can still spread because those female plants produce lots and lots of fruits, and the birds pick them up and move them around to all your neighbors' places. But my guess is you're not the only one in your area who has them. So maybe take a look around. And late in the fall, when buckthorn's the only thing still with leaves on, look around within a mile or so of your place and see if other people have buckthorn. And if you're the only one that has it, then you might want to consider trying to get rid of them because you're causing them to be spread elsewhere.
Yeah, and And you can just focus your efforts on the female plants to be more efficient. Since you like the visual appearance, we just want to get rid of those viable fruit that are being produced. So just target the plants that are producing viable seed and that have fruit present.
Good points. Robert in La Crosse, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Got a question. The DNR folks, each one has their separate niche and their own particular resource in which they're interested, and sometimes wonder if don't lose track of the broad picture. Sorry, Kelly, not meaning to insult you personally, but I know how it is when you get compartmentalized. I was wondering about the mowing early in order before the flowers come in order to get the seed. I understand the logic of that, but we also hear tell about mowing along roadsides. Don't mow too early because of the ground nesting birds.
Yeah, well, I can definitely answer that. So we've had a lot of studies done on grassland birds and what nest in what areas. And for the most part, what they find that nest in along the roadsides are red-winged blackbirds and pheasants. And pheasants, of course, are not even native. And both of those are pretty generalist nesters. They don't need roadsides necessarily to mow on, to nest on. And so what they do find also is that when plants like wild parsnip completely take over on an area on a grassland, then it eliminates the other plants that that most of the birds and native insects and other pollinators would actually be using. And so by allowing these invasives to spread, you're actually reducing the biodiversity there and reducing habitat for those ground nesting birds, whereas by controlling them, you're actually allowing for more diversity.
Hmm. There we go.
The other question then we got at pollinators, butterflies, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of answered that. I mean, are the butterflies, are there other flowers that are blooming at the time, or are you hurting the flowers that the pollinators like by mowing early? So that you reduce the number of butterflies and other pollinators.
Totally depends on the site and what's growing there. You know, everything blooms at slightly different times, and the different insects are out at different times at different stages of their life cycle. And, you know, no matter when you mow, you're going to probably be killing some insects or at least reducing habitat for some insects. And it's just a matter of balance. You can't manage for everything at the same time. It's impossible.
Yeah, and a great example of how mowing has actually been a benefit on our roadsides, this one mow system, is we're seeing an active spread of world milkweed, which is one of the species that our monarch butterflies thrive on. It's actually spreading on our roadsides, and I think the reason it's spreading is because we're mowing those areas earlier. That's a late emerging and late developing plant, shifting the competitive advantage to that world milkweed. So sometimes it can have some benefits, but that's the benefit to one pollinator, you know, monarch butterflies. Yeah. And do we want to target that one or others? And that's a big question. And
absolutely. So lots to consider there, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it very much. We had, we were talking earlier about Virginia creeper, and a caller in northern Wisconsin says that Virginia creeper is not deer proof, and her yard, the deer just love it and eat it right up, which I'm pretty sure that to be the case. Jeff in Iron County was just at the Wisconsin Trappers Convention in Marshfield, missed a talk by a person named Larry Meyer about the negative impact of invasive species on the muskrat population. Do either of you have any information on that?
Well, just that muskrats tend to, live in cattail marshes oftentimes, and our native cattails are pretty much being eliminated because they're hybridizing with the non-native cattail, and the hybrid is actually really swamping out our native cattails. And the other invasive species that's getting into that area is Phragmites. And I don't think that we see muskrats using Phragmites, and certainly not reed canary, the third big invasive plant in wetlands, as much as they would be our native cattails.
We have on Facebook, Rachel sent a photo. I'm not sure if we can figure this one out. I had this plant-tree show up in my yard this spring. Wasn't sure what it was and if I should pull it out. I had a very large seed, and I'm not sure how it would have made its way here. How did I go about identifying it?
Well, first of all, large seeded plants like trees especially get moved around by squirrels and other rodents, mm-hmm. and they tend to bury those seeds and then forget about them, and so then they pop up wherever they were growing. So the picture looks like it could be a hickory, which is a native tree. It's also possible, because it's a seedling, that it could be something like a black walnut or possibly even tree of heaven, which is a non-native. So it's really hard to tell from a seedling because they tend to not have their the same shape as the true leaves, which are the fully mature leaves.
So a little bit tough to figure that one out. And I thought I had another one here I was going to point out to you guys. There was Craig sent a photo. What kind of an animal might have caused those divots in his property? And we were just talking about squirrels, and it could have been squirrels. It might even be skunks.
Or raccoons. Digging up worms or something else.
So those are some possibilities. We have Rod in Rusk County up next. Rod, thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. Another good program. Can you hear me? Because my phone was acting up, she said.
Yeah, it's okay now.
Okay. I had a question for the DNR lady. You know, my dad used to say that when they were clearing land and stuff, they used to see a lot of that grass that was called blue joint. And, you know, I guess, well, they caught it for hay, and, of course, the cows, you know, pasture. But as far as, you know, talking about being native, you wonder if that was even native because, you know, when this was all timber, you know, a lot of these things probably weren't here to begin with. But anyhow, since the land is cleared, if that blue joint is real beneficial to certain wildlife and stuff.
Sure. Well, blue joint is native to Wisconsin. It's a wetland grass that grows in kind of damp sedge meadows, and it's native throughout the state. And, you know, the northern forest wasn't all forest. There were definitely patches of wetlands in there, too, and sedge meadows. And that was where it was native. And then, you know, when the timber got cut and in any kind of wet areas, then at that time, probably blue joint was one of the things that moved into those wetter areas that were then opened up. So, yes, it is a good native plant.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Okay, thank you. Hey, I got another question.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, another thing, you know, like my dad used to always say about these, the lakes and the ponds and stuff, you know, around here, you know, they're aging, they're filling up. Now, I know by Madison, they supposedly, that's quite a few years ago already, they spent millions and they dredged the Mendota and Mendota lakes, and I'm just wondering if there's any way that they can work something out for, you know, where some of these grown over swamps and stuff, people refer to them as a swamp or a wetland. But I know I had a backhoe from my job. I used and borrowed it, and I dug out in a swamp there that was, it was pretty much all rip gut, you know. And, I mean, I sucked that thing down to about 10 feet, and I dug kind of a hole in there. And do you know what? It's all cattails right there and all.
Yeah, well, if you're going to be digging in a wetland, you need to have a permit to do that because wetlands are highly valuable natural communities, and they're very important on the landscape. And even if something used to be a lake at some time and has gradually filled in, that wetland is still a valuable place. And so, you're definitely not supposed to just go in and start digging.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, Rod, for calling. Appreciate it. And Carol and Antigo, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Listen, I've got something growing in my lawn. First of all, I live in the township of Antigo, so I'm outside of the city limits. I'm in the farm country.
Okay.
And you can definitely tell by the lay of the land, you know, as you're walking across the lawn, that it was farm at one point because there's, you know, lots of hills and valleys that go.
Yeah.
But I think when they built the house, which was probably 30 years ago-ish, they just kind of threw whatever out there that they wanted to for a lawn, okay? So I have a partial lawn and lots of weeds. And one of them that comes up, it happens that my dog is allergic to it. And it's known as a bunch of different names. Mayweed, stinky mayweed, wild daisy, and it's actually part of the dog fennel family, and it's related to wild chamomile. I don't want to put any kind of herbicide on my lawn because my well is only 20 feet deep. Is there any other way to get rid of this particular weed? Because it's just rampant throughout the yard.
Yeah, there are several options here. So mayweed is the common name of it. And if you're absolutely right. If you crush the leaves and smell it, it smells like chamomile. And the reason it smells like chamomile is I believe that's what they use to make chamomile.
Yes, and the stem is real woody, and if you crush that, it's got a real stinky, almost a skunk-like scent.
Yep. So it is an annual plant, and it's a indication, exactly like you said, that you have a little bit of a weak turf or weak lawn type environment. So the recommendations I'm going to give is to promote robust turf growth. So that means you need to mow at the appropriate height, fertilize, and now is an awesome time to fertilize to try and promote turf development. And those two things, if you can do those two things this fall, I think that you want to be mowing at around 4 inches tall, and that will help prevent those seeds from germinating the following year. So this year you're kind of out of luck. Next year you got a lot of options. I would start with a fall fertilization program. And you have to evaluate if this is a full sun environment or not.
Mm-hmm. They seem to grow in full sun and in partial shade. They do not grow in full shade.
Yeah. Yep.
There you go. So the proper mowing height and the fertilizing, I mean, this is really kind of the ideal time for fertilizing.
Yep, I think so. If you could give a little shot of fertilizer this fall and then work on improving its mowing, if it needs improving, don't mow it too low. That's usually what kind of allows those to get established.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. I appreciate it. Susan on Facebook, I don't believe we've addressed this, talking about Canada thistle. She says, if we eliminate Canada thistle, what about wild bird species like goldfinches? What are they going to use for nesting materials and food source?
Well, the goldfinches were here a long time before the Canada thistle was, and they found nesting supplies at that time before humans introduced the Canada thistle from Europe. So it's there's many other native thistle species that also have that kind of downy fluff that they can use. Milk, I don't know if they use milkweed fluff or not, but certainly that's getting a lot more milkweeds out on the landscape, with a lot of people intentionally planting milkweeds for native pollinators. And you know, there are a number of other things that I'm sure that they can use. They are resourceful, and they don't have to depend on one non-native species.
Don called and mentioned that we're talking about townships, and the Wisconsin townships have an association, and you can get information on the from the association if you go to wisktowns.com. So if you go to www.wisktowns.com, I think we'll post that up. Randy will post that up on our Facebook page. So if you want to find out about your township and how to contact it, that's a good way to do it. Josh on Facebook asks about orange Calendula officinalis that's taking over, wondering if that, I don't know that.
That's calendula, which is
Is that what it is?
A plant that people use for the edible flowers, and they're bright orange.
What it is.
Never heard of it taking over at all. It's not the easiest plant to even get started. So I'd be really surprised if that's what it is that is spreading. Certainly the only orange-flowered, low-growing plant that I can think of that is pretty invasive is hawkweed. Which is pretty common, especially in the central part of the state where pretty sandy soils.
So hawkweed is something to maybe be a little worried about. Dave in Waukesha wonders if vinegar plus salt and Dawn dishwashing soap effective on buckthorn, and how would you apply it? So vinegar is acetic acid. You add some salt and Dawn dishwashing liquid sort of for the oil effect of it. Is that going to work on buckthorn?
So vinegar is acetic acid, as Larry mentioned. And acetic acid, what it does is to plants is it breaks the plant membrane up in plants and allows the stuff inside, the cytoplasm, to leak out. If applied at the right concentration, it can be effective at doing so. But the problem with this acetic acid or vinegar is it doesn't move throughout the plant. It only attaches the surface. So it works really well if you have very small seedlings that aren't very tall, that you can get really good coverage, and essentially by defoliating them with this application, they don't have enough energy to regrow. Now, something like buckthorn, if you were to spray it on that whole plant, you would potentially cause some damage to the leaves, but that bark is way too thick. None of that will get absorbed through the bark, and you will have very, very minor injury compared to some of the other removal techniques. So it is an effective tool. I would say that you don't need the salt or the dish soap. You know, the one concern I would tell listeners who would like to try this is that if you are using a high dosage of acetic acid, between 5 and 10%, you can get some agitation or burn on your skin. So you do need to be careful if you are utilizing that as a control method, and wear gloves just like you would if you were applying a pesticide.
I wanted to go back. We talked earlier about the UW Extension and Wisconsin DNR are holding some educational sessions for people to learn more about invasive plants, and I think invasive earthworms, too. I guess all earthworms are invasive for Wisconsin, to be perfectly honest. But what about those workshops? And give us the background on that again, will you, Mark?
Yeah, sure. And so these are going to start occurring actually tomorrow. Kelly and I are going to go on a two-week trip to go to these six locations to try and educate people about invasive species. And again, the goal is to give them a broad background about invasive species, what the regulations are in Wisconsin, and how to identify them, and what are some of the resources available, like much of the stuff we've talked about today. And then in the afternoon, we're going to have field workshops where we're actually going to be out in the field showing you how to apply some of these control treatments, showing you this is, you know, Oriental bittersweet. You need to look here to identify this species, calibrating a sprayer, and how to identify these earthworms. So we're really trying to keep a practical point of view. This series of workshops are really set up for municipal employees, but anyone is welcome to attend. So I would encourage you, if you have interest and want more training in invasive species, this is the event for you to go to. We tried to keep prices nominal to try to encourage people to attend. Registration is still open in most of the locations, and I would encourage you to call and contact those local county agents, and they can help you get registered.
And we have a list up on our Facebook page of the places and locations. Brandy's got those up on our Facebook page. So you just go to the Larry Mueller Show. The next, the areas are
sure.
Tomorrow.
So tomorrow we're going to be in Oshkosh. On the 16th, we're going to be in Green Bay at the Bay Beach Wildlife Sanctuary. And then the following day, the 17th, we're going to be in Menominee at the Judicial Center. Then it's not till September 22nd. We'll be in Clinton. That's in Rock County. October 1st at the Retzner Nature Center in Waukesha. And then the 2nd will be up in Stevens Point giving presentations. So if you're interested in registering, you can just contact your local county agent. They'll have that information, or go look it up on the Facebook page that Larry said it's posted on.
Yep. And again, thank you. Boy, we're out of time. Thank you. So, boy, it really flew by today. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. We'll get you back and we'll do this all over again at some point here. Thanks. Kelly Kearns, Invasive Plant Coordinator for the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation Program of the Wisconsin DNR. Mark Renz is an associate professor and agronomist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and UW Extension. And they'll be back, and we'll have them back again. Just take a look ahead. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about beer brewing at 11 with the author of the Mastering Home Brew. And then at 11:45, we'll learn how to keep the family happy at the dinner table with the author of a new cookbook. It's called Dinner Solved. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.